Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. It's always exciting to speak to entrepreneurs whose products are flying off the shelf, especially when the product is category busting. But it's even more exciting to speak to someone who's bringing energy to a category in a downturn, which is where wine is right now. Amy Troutmiller is the CEO of Really Good Boxed Wine, founded in 2021, and she has helped to reinvent the entire boxed wine category in the US. And the market has responded with boxes flying off the shelves. Check this. In the last quarter of 2023, Really Good Boxed Wine reported 417% growth. As you listen to this podcast, one thing stands out. The way to get people excited about wine is to offer them the good stuff and put it in a convenient package. But I'll let her tell you the story. And in an act of generosity, Amy has created a discount code. If you're in the US and you want to try the wine, just order online and quote the code DRINKSINSIDER, all caps, one word, to get 15% off. As always, the takeaways will be in the newsletter, which you can sign up for at drinksinsider.com. Hi, Amy. Great to see you.
You as well, Felicity. Thanks for having me.
It's such a pleasure. Right. Can you start by telling me about your early days working in hospitality and how you got into it?
Absolutely. So I'm considered a lifer, right? An industry term. I've been around it for basically my whole working life. Like many people, I started in restaurants in my teenage years as a means to have some fun money and things like that. And over time, it was a job for the first probably 8 years. It was a means to an end. It allowed me to have flexibility in my life, go to college, all those things. And in my early 20s, I had this moment where I realized that I really loved the industry and what I was doing and wanted to figure out a way to make it a career. And so that was the point where I really focused on what I needed to learn, what I wanted to do next, and dive into it in a more meaningful way.
How did your parents react when you went, "Mom, Dad, I'm going to go into serving and hospitality for my life"? Were they happy or unhappy?
Funny enough, I was kind of born into it. My dad actually was in the Army, and when he came home and left the Army, he was a restaurant manager.
Oh,
where
okay.
He met my mom as an 18-year-old, and that's how they met. And then my dad continued in that industry. When I was 3 years old, I was bussing tables and helping out at restaurants. It was a logical leap. And I'm very fortunate that at no point in time were my parents ever, you have to do this, or they really allowed me to be who I was and explore what I wanted to explore.
I need to know, as a three-year-old, did you make big tips?
Well, my dad did give me like 25 cents an hour for my piggy bank. I recall some, older people especially thinking it was adorable and sliding me a dollar here and there. But, more than anything, my dad had bought me this cute little like fake waitress outfit. And so I just remember being that age and loving to wear this little apron and feeling like a big person.
Okay, there's a difference between hospitality and wine, but you achieved sommelier certification. So what took you down the wine path?
Yeah, I always was very curious. In my early days of the restaurant industry, it was wanting to understand how things were made and, really have always had that sort of curious nature. And early on in my career, I was actually part of the very early mixology movement. I did contract work with Bacardi when they started expanding the Bacardi flavors and they acquired Grey Goose. And I was into that part of it really initially first and enjoyed wine and drinking wine on my own. And I would take notes just naturally on what I liked. And I would always try to explore wine. But it was in my first leadership role where I oversaw a wine program that I really started to understand the nuance and the differences between regions and varietals. And I had a very sort of pivotal moment when I was probably 23 And it was tasting Foglia Tonda Cassetta, which is the backstory is incredible. It was what they thought was an extinct grape in Italy. Mm. And one man had a vine in his backyard and they rediscovered it in the 70s. And it, basically all of it that's planted comes from this one vine that this man had curated and kept alive in his backyard. And there was just this completely different experience from smelling it to the initial taste to the finish that I felt transported. And from that moment, it was like, okay, I have to know more. And so that was when I really started my study. And I was fortunate enough that I was overseeing a beverage program. And so I got to taste, you know, 50 to 100 bottles a week with reps. And I really was able to, you know, go in feet first. And I did get my sommelier certification in my 20s and, you know, just have never slowed down on the passion that that sparked.
So what period was this?
This was in the early aughts, so around 2007.
So that was the time, that was the sort of the peak expansion of the wine market where I think it was probably the most exciting.
Yeah, and I was living in Chicago at the time, so a really ripe wine market where I had access to a lot of things.
Okay, now I was fascinated in when I did a bit of a deep dive into your background to discover that you were a founding member of something called the Ladies United for the Preservation of Endangered Cocktails. That sounds awesome. What was it, and what kickstarted you into doing that?
Yeah, you know, again, I did have a really strong background in mixology, and when I moved to Chicago, I had met several other women, one being Sonia Castlebaum, who founded the first distillery outside of Chicago and one of the Chicago suburbs still going today, North Shore Distillery. A few others, Bridget Alpert, who is, you know, very up. She leads education for Southern Wine and Spirits now. There was just this group of women that was all very passionate about cocktails. And I believe the first division, the true founding, was in Boston. And we were the second or third chapter of what is called LUPEC, the Ladies United for the Preservation of Endangered Cocktails. And the whole premise was that we would, one, you know, get together and have a theme. And it could be, you know, tiki. It could be, you know, at the bourbon, rye, whatever. It could be a spirit or a specific time period theme. And then we did events that were supported charities that directly impacted women and promoted to the public these ideas of, you know, true traditional cocktails.
Do you think the cocktails really were endangered? Was that a cute thing, or were they endangered? Had they dropped out?
I think that we were still in the era of, you know, the Cosmopolitan and the Appletini and things like that. You'd have in major cities, really, and only in major cities, sort of that speakeasy beginning to rise up. Charles Jolly is a good example. He was already, you know, running a program in Chicago where you could get a Ramos Gin Fizz and you could get a Harvey Wallbanger and things that people weren't really drinking at the time. Now, in the 10 years post 2007, obviously that changed very drastically. I won't claim that we had a piece of that movement and it had, you know, a major impact, but those are things now that you rarely go anywhere, even in small towns, and you can't find, you know, you'll find a Manhattan, you'll find these things on menu.
That must have been so much fun. You know, does it still exist?
It does. Yeah. Yeah. It's you more so have local bartenders guilds that really do these type of events, prohibition parties and things like that on December 5th every year. And it is less prominent as it was, you know, what now, 15 years ago, 18 years ago, 17 years ago. But it does still exist. Yes.
Okay. So you went from working in hotels and restaurants to founding a partner in a regional distributor, and then becoming a sole executive, a national importer and distributor. So, and you founded a consulting company. So how did you go from that to that? What was the story?
Yeah. You know, I spent really in leadership roles about 16 years in hospitality, primarily in hotels. And you work hard, like it's a tough life. And, you know, there can be late nights and I had a career I was really proud of, but I really didn't have anything else. Both my parents were ill. My dad had passed away in December of 2012. And I kind of looked and reflected and thought to myself, like, this, I can't do this forever if I want a more robust life. And unfortunately, you know, there, I did not have many female role models that had families or anything in the industry. And so I knew that I still wanted to be a part of it. There, you know, I have too much passion for what I do, and I needed to figure out how I could remain a part of this industry, but also have everything I wanted in life. And I was very fortunate that I was able to help somebody who was looking at starting an import and distribution business with no knowledge of it, just thought, this is my entry into this world. I was able to be that founding partner that did have the knowledge and, you know, started that company with them.
Just going back to this topic that you've touched on, it's incredibly important. I mean, the world of being a sommelier or working in hospitality is incredibly hostile to having a family and having a life. It's very difficult. Do you think there's a clear pathway, a career pathway for people, or do you think it's still a struggle that you get in and then you don't have many options?
It's absolutely still a struggle. The hours obviously is one piece of it. There can be, depending on the level of, you know, where you're at in the industry, there can be inconsistencies in income. Often, you know, people don't want to get into the management track because they'll be taking a pay cut initially. A lot of the industry is still pretty grossly underpaid for the work that it does entail. And I think we have a long way to go. There's a lot that has gotten better, especially since the pandemic. What people prioritize and demand, you know, from their employers has gone a long way. But I think there's still a lot of true issues that prevent people from being able to have a true career in the industry, especially women.
Yeah, there's a lot we could talk about there, but let's go back to you. So you were now in a completely different role. Did you find it difficult? Was it a steep learning curve, or was it a continuation of what you'd already been doing?
The learning curve was, I'm a pretty passionate learner. Like if I don't know something, I'm going to figure it out. And I love to dive into new things. The biggest, I think, learning curve was I went in thinking, oh, I have all of these friends in the industry that are buyers, that are the decision makers. So now that I have a product that I'm selling, my friends are all going to buy it. And, you know, and that's just not how it works. You can't rely on the fact that, hey, you know, switch out this, buy the glass of wine that's selling so well for you just because you know me and take something that I have. So it was a long build. I mean, for the first 14 months, I was the only employee. I did everything from, you know, sourcing and sales and finance and, you know, the entirety of the business. And it was a slog. You know, I was dragging a bag and then coming home at night and doing invoicing and, you know, every little piece of it. And my best customers weren't people I even knew before. And so that was the biggest learning is that it really is, you know, one, you have to lead with quality. You have to have something different than everybody else who has a book and is dragging a bag around the city. But that the relationships that you have before aren't, it's all about building new relationships too.
That is so interesting. So a lot of the audience for this podcast are actually people who want to get into the US market, who want to come and talk to people like you. What sort of mistakes did you see people making when they approached importers?
I think one of the biggest mistakes is the fact that people kind of all want to go to the same places as far as what markets they want to be in. And most often those are very saturated and can be very costly to break into those markets as far as marketing dollars and how you're going to support and get your product in front of people, whether that's incentivizing reps, incentivizing buyers, if it's, you know, offering extra samples, hosting dinners and tastings and everything else. That's one issue. Two is pricing. I think people really very often get their pricing wrong. I think that you have a lot of vineyards who start off, you know, relying on their tasting room or their local market, and especially an international wine, they don't necessarily understand the three-tier system, how many markups there are before it reaches the end consumer. They don't necessarily understand that we're basically 50 countries because every state has its own laws. And some of those states have an additional layer of markup at the state level. And so pricing is really one of the biggest issues, and making sure that it's the right price for the product, both in quality, presentation, and category.
Interesting. All right. So let's get to the purpose of this interview. You are now CEO of Really Good Boxed Wine. How did you come to that role? And it launched, I think, in August 2021. Can you explain the whole story from where you are now?
Yeah, absolutely. So the other co-founder of Really Good Boxed Wine is Jake Whitman. And Jake came to want to create this product, our winery, as a consumer. He was in, you know, his background is executive marketing roles in tech and or fintech and CPG. So very smart, very, you know, incredible guy who just saw this need, because he ended up in a lot of places where glass was either inconvenient or or not allowed, right? So he would do outdoor concerts or picnics in a park, or, you know, living in a building where you couldn't take a glass bottle to a communal area by your, you know, apartment building pool or anything like that. And so he started to buy box for those occasions. And every time he'd be like, well, this isn't good. Let me try the next one. And really got to the point where he just didn't understand why there wasn't good boxed wine. And so he did a deep dive and started to try to understand it must be a technical reason. And once he realized that there wasn't a technical reason, just nobody was doing it, he's like, I'm going to do it. And I give him tons of credit, because unlike Europe, where you have mobile boxing trucks and, you know, things, there's just more of an infrastructure to be able to have somebody box your wine. In the US, you really had three institutional, you know, companies, very big companies, who control the box market, and they have their own boxing lines.
Oh, so I hadn't actually considered that.
Yeah, there isn't a lot of options for if you want to do this without spending a couple $100,000 on a piece of equipment. And he was able to, before I even came into the fold, kind of lay out that groundwork and infrastructure for this company to be realized. And
hang on, let me just stop you. How do you do that? If there aren't the facilities around, how do you solve that problem?
So there are very few.
There are some though.
Right. And the issue with the couple that there were are, you know, your minimum runs and everything else. And when you're just starting off with no or very little money to get going and you're trying to launch a new winery, a lot of times they won't give you the time of day if you don't have enough money to produce a very large amount. And he had enough relationships and was able to really tell the passion behind, this is what we're doing and it's different. Can you work with us and just give us a shot? And he did that legwork. And I give him so much credit for that, especially being from outside the industry. So he was able to convince one of the very few to give us a shot.
That's really interesting. So does it work like with bottling lines or with book production that you have to try and convince somebody to give you after hours or when they're not doing the big runs, that kind of thing?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So he must be very good at negotiating. And so how did you meet him?
Yeah. He realized very early on that while he had some of these things figured out, he did not know the industry, and he was looking for a partner in this business that knew the industry and understood wine. And so he found me through that consulting business. Obviously, I had a website and blogs and everything. So probably just Google searching, I think, is how he found me. And so within the first few weeks, I came on board. And having been in this industry for decades now, there's very few things that I get incredibly excited about. Mm-hmm. And from the moment that we talked, from the moment that the idea was becoming a reality, it was immediately something I was passionate about and I was all in.
We talked briefly before we started recording, but as you can tell from my accent, I'm Australian, and we invented the bag and box.
Yes.
We have a very long history with it. And now I'm in Europe and there's bag and box everywhere, but the US has not only not adopted it, it's always been slightly hostile to it. So knowing that, what gave you the confidence to launch this product?
A few things. I'm a bit of a data nerd. And so understanding that it is being embraced in the European market, 41%, I believe, was the latest statistic on the French grocers, 41% of the wine sold there is BIB. We are in the US typically 5 to 10 years behind adapting to technology in the alcoholic beverage space to Europe.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you think about the screw cap, there's things that it trickles over to us. It's, you know, and so I felt pretty confident that we were creating this at the very beginning of what would be a big movement. So that was part of it. And the other piece is that, you know, almost 10% of the U.S. market is already boxed wine. It just isn't high quality boxed wine.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
People are comfortable and familiar with the format. The people who aren't drinking it just don't want not great stuff, right? And so we thought there would be a demand.
Well, this is really interesting because this is growing in the UK at the moment with putting premium wine into bag and box. But, you know, one of the issues is that when you've established it as, you know, let's say the commercial end of the market, let's use that word, how do you overcome people's prejudices about that without spending millions on marketing? How did you deal with that problem?
I mean, we still deal with that problem, right? It is ingrained. And I wish we had $1 million to just spend on telling people, you know, that we exist and that these are the benefits and all of that. I think the biggest thing is that we've led with quality. And what's interesting is that the core wine market in the U.S. is over the age of 60. And those are the people who their gateway wine was boxed in the 80s. And so they started off drinking boxed wine regularly and they understand it, but they outgrew, their palate outgrew the quality. And so they moved on to other things. And interestingly, it hasn't been that hard convincing somebody who understands both the benefits of the packaging as well as the quality propositions that we present and that value that they get instead of paying for a bottle that they get by buying our box.
Okay. So tell me about the wine itself. How did you start sourcing it? Where does it come from and so on?
We have been very fortunate in that we don't, I think there's some perception of you have to go through like bulk brokers and everything else. Because I am an industry insider, right? I'm not a founder that is coming in blind. I have decades of relationships. And so most of our wines are from vineyards and people that I've worked with over the years. We do grape contracts. So we do have Tammy Collins is our winemaker. So sometimes it's a grape contract where we bring the grapes to our winery.
You've got a winery. I'm sorry. I didn't know that. Where is your winery?
We don't own any vineyards. You know, we didn't obviously start off with the budget to buy $1 million acres in California. So we work with other vineyard owners and we have a winery in Healdsburg and Sonoma. It's a shared winery space.
It's a crush facility or it's your own winery?
It's a shared space. Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Again, we're you know, still a pretty small, scrappy brand. Maybe someday we'll have a big winery with their own tasting room, but today is not the day. So grape contracts. And then the other is, you know, working with other vineyard owners that I know, we purchase their excess pressed fruit. The good thing is that right now all of our wines are single source and all but one, well, two actually, are single vineyard. And we're able to do that because of these relationships. We're not, you know, we may get to a point at scale where we're having to blend a few vineyards, but they'll all still remain single source. And we work directly with those vineyard owners.
Now, one of the most interesting things about when you have build a brand around packaging, whether it's a canned wine brand or whatever, is the question arises of who is most prominent on the label. Is the brand your brand, which is most prominent, and where the wine comes from isn't that important? Or do you put the where the wine comes from, who makes it? How do you sort out that sort of hierarchy of branding?
Yeah, our biggest differentiator when you look at the box market in general, and there are other higher end boxes that have come about, especially since we started, is the fact that we have that, winemaking information, the region. We're very transparent about the varietals in it. So if it's a blend, you know, the exact varietal breakdown, it doesn't just say red blend and, you know, you get what you get. And the region really, you know, we're working with premium AVAs, sub AVAs. And so that's what is different more so than anything else. And people really care about that. They understand immediately, if they have some wine knowledge, that getting a Russian River Valley product at our price is an exceptional value. And so without that regional designation, I think you lose some of that, you know, luxury quality perception.
And from a technical point of view, are there technical challenges? Are there some varieties that are better off in bag and box and some you shouldn't touch, or is it irrelevant?
I mean, we're not going to replace the bottle entirely, and we'll never intend to. You know, we're not boxing Cheval Blanc, right? And so there are some
not
things.
Not yet. Well, think big.
You know, the one thing is that we have the capability to age wine in our winery, just like anything else. And so we can release it when it's ready to drink. Last fall, we had a 2019 single vineyard Napa Valley Cabernet. And we were, I believe, the first to ever box that type of wine. And so we have those aging capabilities. When we put it in box, you have a, you know, 12 to 18 month clock that starts. And so we want to make sure it's ready to drink. Our current vintage of Pinot Noir is 2022. So, you know, we had that oak age and all of that, and it's ready to drink once we put it in the box. Really, the only restriction is something that you would age in bottle. You're not going to stick a box in your cellar for 15 years sparkling.
Right. Yeah. So I'm not quite sure how to ask this question tactfully, but a lot of brands, especially when they start at a time of grape oversupply, get absolutely sensational material. And then when the grape supply sorts itself out 3 or 4 years later, they don't, you know, you can't quite meet the price because you don't have the exceptional grape material anymore. So California is in oversupply at the moment, so it's a great time to start a brand. But have you thought further down the road about what happens when grape prices go up? Have you priced all of that in?
Yes. And we intentionally are regionally agnostic. That allows us to be able to pivot if there are wildfires or our sources are impacted by drought and there isn't an, you know, so we have been intentional with that. We've been very fortunate thus far to be able to maintain our partnerships with our current vineyards, but we realize that the environment, every vintage, because we're a vintage specific product, there could be variations in both cost, yields, lots of things. So we have kept ourselves open to being able to, change our partners based on those factors. If we can't afford Russian River Valley, it may be a broader Sonoma, product for that vintage. The promise that we make is that it's always really good. Our quality is what we rely on.
I said, let's go back to the founding story. So you've got your business plan, you've got your grape sources, you found somebody who can do it for you. Now, how did you get it to market, especially this category? What were your steps?
Sure. The initial two productions we did were really tiny and were just kind of pilots testing the market. And we had the ability to ship to like 3 states. And even though we only had that small capability, we sold out the first run in 5 days and the second run in 4 days. So we knew there was something.
Who were you selling to?
This was direct to consumer. And Jake, he is actually originally from Ohio and had gotten some nice local state press in Ohio. So we had a number of people in Ohio that wanted to buy it, and then California. So it was a lot of it was really organic PR, just doing some initial outreach on our own, people having that interest. And it kind worked that way. And then word of mouth really traveled quick. We built up a very significant kind of wait list, people wanting to be a part of this. So we found a partner to help us expand our, D2C footprint and officially launched nationally. And when I say nationally, you know, the states that legally allow winery to ship to you, January 28th of 2022.
Okay. Now, I read that you went into explosive growth late last year. What do you think was the reason for that? Was it just a tipping point? What happened?
We had a few factors. One being we really, I believe in listening to our customers. People can get into a rut of who they think their customer is. When we started the brand, we thought we were a millennial product, like early adopters, open-minded, people just getting more into wine. And we learned along the way that that's not necessarily our core customer, and that's great. So how do we talk to the people who really want us and find more of them? And so that was a big piece of it, is understanding and adapting our language and how we talked about the product and who our customer was. And hitting that sort of stride allowed us to find a lot more of those people who were already interested in what we were doing. They just hadn't heard of us yet.
You know, that is a really interesting point. So I've been at the founding of many magazines, and at the time that it happens, the publisher always says, this is who our, you know, target audience is going to be, and this is what we're going to do. And I've learned to go, you know what, the audience is always going to be somebody different than we expect. But actually, a lot of companies don't adapt at that point. They just keep going, no, this is who we go for. So you're obviously very flexible.
Yeah, I mean, you can spend years with a company, not even just in wine, any type of company, trying to shove the square peg into the round hole. And if you're not talking to the people who actually want to be a part of your brand and want to be your customer, you're just never going to grow at the pace that you can.
So, okay, so what sort of feedback are you getting from customers? How are they using the bag-in-box, or where are they using it?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things, so obviously the environmental benefits of box are massive, right? That is one of the biggest reasons that we started and that we push for more people to consider alternative packaging. But despite the fact that 70% of Americans self-report that they take sustainability into account in purchases, it's not the driver for purchase. Mm. And one of the biggest things that we've realized is that the benefit of the fact that you can open our box and it stays fresh for 6 weeks is outweighing most other things except for the quality to value. So moderation is not just a Gen Z thing. It's 51% of the U.S. population of drinkers at every age group. And so everybody is being more considerate of their consumption, and about half of wine drinkers dump at least one bottle a month that they haven't finished. So people are either choosing something else, it's easier to have one drink at a time, or they're abstaining from wine until the weekend, right? Or they're buying something that they wouldn't necessarily want to drink, but they feel less bad if they have to pour some out. So it's not the quality that they want. So even at the older age demographics, people love the fact that they can have that one glass at a time. They might have a partner who doesn't drink at all. They might, you know, just be trying to cut back themselves. But the fact that you have that longevity, you're not wasting anything. It's the quality that you want to be drinking, and it's there kind of on tap.
That is so interesting. It's almost paradoxical that moderation is driving buying in bulk in a way. It's interesting. Yeah. So I didn't actually ask you, what formats does it come in? What size do you sell it in?
Right now, we just have the 3 liter, and that is the equivalent of 4 standard wine bottles. It does give us the best, as far as cost goes, the best sort of quality to value ratio. We're able to reduce the cost. Like if you're paying $15 for a bottle on shelf, by the time it gets marked up through the US system, the bottle itself is costing you, 30% or more of the price of that wine. Our packaging costs are an 80% reduction, and we don't pay to protect glass and multiple shipments and everything else. So we're able to really give people a good 50% savings over the same quality in bottles by doing the 3 liter. Now, we do have plans to offer some format expansion in the future, and we want to diversify that way. But right now it is the 3 liter.
Okay. So at the moment, who is your consumer? It's still the older consumer?
Yeah, about 60% of our customer base is over the age of 55.
Do you think you'll be able to reach younger consumers? Is it just a matter of time, or do you think it is an older person product?
No, we still have almost 2 times the industry index of consumers under the age of 40. So we have drinkers as young as 21 and as old as 94 as our customers.
Okay. Who's the 94-year-old, and how do you know you've got a 94-year-old?
Well, we have to age gate, right? We sell alcohol. So we have to know their age to make sure that it's legal to sell to them. But we do lean heavily towards the older consumer. I think that they have a deeper understanding and wine knowledge, so they get it pretty quickly. What's interesting is that when you're marketing towards Gen Z, they're usually early to wine. Like somebody doesn't start off and start buying, Heights Martha's Vineyard as they're, at 22. Typically they are buying, a $10 bottle here, a $15 bottle there, maybe the $20 box that, is the equivalent of $5 per bottle. And they find their way to what they like. They start having more expendable income, and they find their way to us. We're here for people who really want a better product. And that can happen at a younger age. And it does, and people who have more understanding. But we're not in a constant cycle of customer acquisition with young people. We're that brand that you kind of grow into when you're ready to drink something of incredible quality.
And how much opportunity do you get to meet your consumers? Do you do sampling programs and so on?
Yeah, we absolutely do. So we're only in a few wholesale markets, love tastings. And, you know, it liquid to lips is the phrase, right? The aha moments that happen in real time with people when they taste the product and that light bulb goes off and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe this is that good. And it comes from a box. That's fun. We also have a really loyal wine club and we do club events. And that's just the best. Like these people meet each other, they become buddies in local markets, you know, and it's great to meet those people. And we also have a sort of concierge service where we have customers who will reach out to us and tell us what they're cooking for a party and ask which wines they want to pour, you know, or they should pour with those dishes. So we try to have a great relationship. Our operations manager, who is, I kind of call my Swiss Army knife, her name is Libby, and she has experience doing wine clubs in Napa and everything else. She's been in the industry a long time as well. She picks up the phone and calls customers, you know, a couple a week and just gets to know them and welcome them and, you know, talk to people. And so we really try to have a good relationship.
That's so nice. So I want to unpack this a little bit. So the wine events with boxed wine, how do they work? Does everyone just come in and help themselves or do you have somebody who's pouring? I mean, how does it, what do you do with boxed wine for an event?
Yeah, it depends on the event. We did one that was a wine and caviar on a wow. patio. It was a spring event that we did. And in that situation, we had like this caviar bar set up and the wine set up so people could just go help themselves. We did a more casual event in like a big warehouse where it was tacos and all of that. And that we had a bartender. And so they were pouring and people come up and could taste through. It just really depends on the event. And we do everything from casual to, you know, the high-end luxury experiences.
Wow. That's interesting. Okay, so from all of this contact with consumers, what have you learned that surprised you?
I think the biggest surprise is that we know the consumer wants us. The pushback in the industry is from the distributors and the buyers. It's the gatekeepers who say, oh, this is too expensive for box. Nobody's going to buy this. The consumers actually do want us. And so they're embracing of this product. You know, I'll make a side note here. We do both surveys within our own customer base, both current customers, people who are on our list who've never bought from us before to learn maybe why they haven't, people who are most loyal, we, you know, we'll ask them questions. And we've done commission surveys to learn more about just the market in general. And in a blind survey that we conducted this year, just posing the idea of higher quality box wine, and the only qualifiers to be a part of the study were that you drink wine at least once a month. How much would you pay for this 3-liter if it was, you know, and they don't know who we are or anything, it's all blind questions. And 73% said over $50. And so people are willing to pay for higher quality. We know that across the board with the premiumization of the industry as a whole, but it's the people who are, you know, making the decision on what's on shelf or what's on a menu that are really hesitant.
The more I talk to entrepreneurs, the more I come up against this problem, which I'd never considered, which is when you bust categories, there has to be the right shelf space to put you on, that, you know, there's actually logistical problems to busting categories. How do you talk distributors and wholesalers around, or haven't you been able to?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, we intentionally designed our box to replace a bottle on shelf. We know our customer is a bottle drinker. It's not somebody buying the $20 box. It's somebody buying a $20 bottle who wants a better value. And we designed our box to only replace one bottle slot on shelf. So we can fit there if they'll allow us to. That being said, the main question,
how do you talk the distributors and wholesalers around?
Yeah. So we have only dipped our toes in wholesale. So I will tell you, I haven't had as many conversations as I will in the future. The biggest thing is that you have to be willing to invest in them. Your wholesaler is not going to go out and sell the product for you in most instances nowadays. So having a marketing plan, having done market research, developing a key account list, having everything ready even before you approach them and say, look, we want to be your partner. We're not asking you to do the heavy lifting. We're here to be your partner. Here's our plan. Here's how we're going to invest in the market. Here's how we're going to make sure it's a success. And here's how we're going to support sell through once we do get the doors open. So I think that has to be a big part of it. But it is, I will tell you, it's the hardest convincing I've ever had to do, even with the few markets that we are in, of trying to take a product.
So I'm glad you brought up the topic of money, which I haven't asked yet. But, even if you're doing small runs and so on, it's still very expensive to launch a brand. Where did the money come from? Was it investment money? Did you put your own money in? Talk me through the finances of this.
Sure. In August 2021, we started with a very, very small friends and family kind of situation. Yeah, not very much money at all. And we stretched that really far. Over a year, we were able to stretch that little bit of money. We raised a seed round of funding in 22, fall of, I think we closed around in November of 2022, and that helped us really invest in learning. And so we are now at a place where we've right-sized all of our margins. We have a clear path to profitability. We've done all the hard work to kind of accelerate growth. And so we're currently fundraising now. And that is, hopefully to get us all the way to the moon.
Yeah, hopefully. When you did your seed round, you were doing it just at the moment when, investment money had begun to dry up and because interest rates had gone up. So it must have been quite a difficult time. What were the arguments that you used to unlock funding for what was basically a new category?
Yeah, I think, again, you rely a lot on data. I love data. My experience is probably what I rely on the most. And secondly, it's being open to being wrong and actually reading the numbers, right? Numbers most often don't lie. So understanding really the trends of where the industry was going, knowing that what we had already proven and our confidence in our forecasting, we've been very fortunate with a vintage product to have less than 1% spoilage and loss ever. Mm-hmm. So really having proven, one, that there's demand for what we're doing, there's market fit, we're the right people to, lead the brand, we understand what we're, making and building. And I think a lot of it was people think wine is cool. Have it in your portfolio. Say you own a little piece of a winery, and so leaning into that a little. But the investment market is very tough, and it's even harder in the vice space because so many people do not invest in alcohol, cannabis, whatever. So you're already limited on who's there, to potentially be investors. And then, we're not AI. Everybody's focused on things like that now. But we have something great and we have a really healthy business that, is investable and will eventually make somebody a nice return.
When you walked into those pitch meetings, how many did you have to do before somebody invested?
We were fortunate to have a lead investor early on who got on board and believed in us. And it's always helpful when you have some of the money already. And then it helps to allow the rest to sort of trickle behind that. But I would say, you can have 50 conversations and one person says yes.
Interesting. So the more conversations you had, did it refine your pitch or did you go and do the same pitch every time and then find it unlocked somebody's interest?
No, I think it always refines your pitch. And I think you run across, a lot of times people ask the same questions. And so you're armed with those answers.
So what can I ask? Sorry, interrupted.
Yeah. No, a lot of times it is, I will tell you, 50% of people really want to know what the exit strategy is, right? If they're putting their money in, they want to know when it's coming out. What does that look like? And how likely is an exit? And so that's a lot of it and kind of talking to them about what that possibility is in the future. Otherwise, it's really making sure that we're strategic and planning and that we can back up what we're saying. So it's you can't just throw out numbers and guesses and, you know, make things up to try to convince somebody. It's really making sure that, you know what you're talking about and that there's factual information backing up what you're saying.
What is your exit strategy? Is this going to be like make millions of dollars and then sell it? Or is this something that your children are going to have? What do you want to do in the end with it?
You know, this is hard for me because it's my baby, right? I love it so much. The reality is that we will hit a, kind of an inflection point where we either have to buy the vineyards and invest really heavily in the operational infrastructure of this business, or look for somebody to acquire or partner with us that has that infrastructure and can, 100x what we've done because they've already built that. And I would say that latter is the most likely. And it's mm-hmm. because I want the brand to live on. We'll hit a ceiling of what we can accomplish without some of those pieces that other people have built. And we have built a brand on trust. And because of the fact that we are regionally agnostic, there's a lot of flexibility for somebody who already owns vineyards and has that excess fruit to kind of plug and play. And so I think that if it's the right person who will treat the brand properly and allow it to live on, we have to consider that.
Going back to building the market, so you mentioned that you had a PR-led strategy and that helped in Ohio and so on. But when you're doing multiple states, it becomes very expensive. Did you stick with the PR strategy all the way? Do you hire influencers? How do you do your marketing?
Yeah, so again, we've been very fortunate that word of mouth is probably our most powerful marketing tool. We have an extremely high repeat purchase rate. People, when they find us, love us and come back. And so those people are entertaining at their home and sharing our wine or taking a box to a party, and then somebody else finds out about us. A good example is the Villages in Florida, which is a big retirement community. And it's a very social atmosphere and people are driving around on their golf carts and stuff. And we noticed a few people in the Villages bought our wine and we kind of laughed like, oh, we finally made it. Like, we're in the Villages and just kind of this funny joke because we do have a somewhat older consumer base. And then all of a sudden you'd see 10 more people in the Villages buying our wine. And we realized that there are influencers, right? That we're not paying them, but people are buying our wine and sharing mm-hmm. it. And then that's our biggest marketing tool, really. We use all the traditional platforms. Our brand name is probably the most valuable SEO tool mm. you could imagine. You Google yeah. Box Wine, but we show up second.
Did you plan it that way or did it just turn out to be a great
yes.
coincidence?
Yes. Initially, yes. Now, mm-hmm. I will tell you, we have an issue now because when we started, we were the only one. And so that's great. We're really good box wine. And it's kind of just on the nose. If somebody's looking for it, obviously they'd find us by typing in those words. So yeah, it was intentional. But now we've become a category. And so it's very different in retail, right? If somebody calls and says to a retail shop, hey, do you have any really good box wine? They might list, any number of box wines. Oh, sure. Yes, we do. And it's not us. So we are currently looking at a brand evolution that will allow us to, really take our place in the market without losing what we've built. And it's a fun exercise and we're kind of involved in that now. But yeah, it was definitely intentional. Obviously we use Meta, you kind of have to. I'd love to give them less money, but in order to get brand awareness, it's almost a necessary evil now. Yeah, the PR machine, we do a lot in-house. We're a tiny team. And so we hustle and we do as much as we can in-house. Our influencers, per se, are really not paid people. We tap into people who love the product. I have friends and we have customers all the time who send us pictures of them drinking it somewhere or pictures, and we say, hey, do you mind if we use that? Okay, great. And so a lot of it comes from people who are already loving and drinking our product.
It's funny what you said about Florida, because I've got friends of mine who are retirees who live in Charleston and I've been to visit them. And when I go to the bar, it's people just knocking back wine. And I'm always like, why is everyone talking about Gen Z? They should be targeting communities like this. This
Absolutely.
Is where money is.
I mean,
they don't care about their health.
Yeah, I know, right? But it's still, I think it's 70% of the dollars spent in the wine industry is still people over the age of 60. So if you're ignoring them, you got a much smaller slice of the pie.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so final thoughts. How do you see the boxed wine category evolving in the US?
You know, I tell people all the time, especially retail buyers who have hesitation, that, you know, give it 5 years and you'll have 10 boxes on shelf over $50. It's the direction that the industry is going, in the sense that if you do look at the numbers, right, there's a lot of doom and gloom talk right now, but premium box wine has grown 17.3% year over year. It's the shining light in the wine industry. The convenience, the benefits, the fact that it is moderation friendly are all things that I don't think are going to go away, and it's going to continue to grow. I am excited. You know, there's two or three, sometimes more, entrants into this space every year. We're friendly with all of them. It's the idea that rising tides lift all ships, and there's no reason that there isn't room for multiple of us to be out there. And it actually works in our favor to be able to say to a retailer, look, here's five. Do a section and see what your customers say. And so it really is, I think, something that we'll see more of. And I'm hopeful for this portion, this subcategory.
Well, with the moderation trend and the desire for, you know, better portion sizes and stuff, have you considered cans, or are you going to stick to boxed wine?
I haven't not considered cans. One of my weak spots is champagne, sparkling wine in general, primarily champagne, because I'm a wine snob at the end of the day. And so I'd love to find a way to do some bubbles, and can is probably one of the better options in alternative format to do that. I will tell you that I could count on one hand the number of canned wines that I've tasted that are passably good. There are more challenges, I think, with the preservation and the quality control. We definitely are currently looking into smaller size alternative format, but not cans at the moment.
Okay. So, all right. So final question. When you look across the landscape, as you say, there is a lot of gloom and doom. Where do you think the big opportunities still are?
I think that we have to get the conversation away from the health sort of doom and gloom aspect that any amount of alcohol is terrible. Sure, any amount of a lot of things are terrible, right, for our bodies. Wine is inherently communal. It is affordable luxury, unlike most products. There are moments of friendship, joy. It fits into life in a way that when we connect with people and people connect with one another, wine can be at the center of that. And it has been in many cultures. We're still a very young wine drinking society in America. So it's not as ingrained as what you have at your dinner table, and you see your parents having that growing up and generations of it being, you know, part of a meal. But that's where we need to connect people, is that we're not telling you to drink the whole bottle. In fact, we're telling you the opposite at really good box wine, right? We're saying just have one glass, and you can, or just have two glasses. There are so many positive things that come from the experience and the emotion and everything else that revolves around what we do as an industry, that I think our biggest risk right now is people not connecting with that emotional piece and how we fit into people's lives.
All right. Well, on that very optimistic note, I'll say thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Felicity. This has been fun.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.